Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I am with, as always, my co-host Frank Cogliano. How are you doing this week, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much. Hello, everyone.
We are recording this week from my luxurious office here in the old medical school. Before we begin, we want to apologize for the audio quality for last week. We knew there was a lot of background noise, so this week we've sequestered ourselves in my office on the hopes that the audio quality is a little bit better. As I think anyone listening to this knows, we are not radio professionals by any means.
We demonstrate that every week, David.
Yes, we have competence in some fields, or at least we have degrees to claim that we do. But audio engineering isn't one of them, so we're still sort of amateurs at all this. All right, for this week we've got two big topics. One, based on an article by Rick Perlstein in the New York Times Magazine, why did historians not predict the rise of Donald Trump? Why was the Trump candidacy and election a surprise to historians? Topic two, we're going to look, this is in part based on a listener question, the story about United Airlines last week with the passenger being forcibly removed from the plane. A lot of people talked about that story in the context of their anger at the airline, but it's also a story about police power and police brutality in some ways. And so we want to talk about the relationship there between corporations and police power and the ways in which those have historically worked together. All right, so topic number one about this article in the New York Times magazine by Rick Perlstein. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. But for those people who haven't had a chance to look at it yet, Frank, what's the basic gist of this piece?
Thanks, David. Rick Perlstein has kind of set himself up as the Edward Gibbon, if you will, on the rise of the American right.
If only he had, because there'd be decline and fall of the American right.
That's true. And he's written a series of books over the past 15 or 16 years, beginning very long books, but wonderfully written. I can recommend all of them, that chronicle the rise of the right in the United States from the 1964 election and Barry Goldwater's doomed candidacy down to the rise of Reagan. Mm. And they're a series of wonderful books. Perlstein wrote a bit of a mea culpa in last week's New York Times Magazine, in which he said, basically, I've got it all wrong, and so too did all the other historians mm-hmm. of this topic, because we missed out on Trump.
Yeah.
And we can't explain Trump necessarily. I will say, parenthetically, when I was in the U.S., I caught up with a friend of mine who holds a joint appointment in both political science and history at an American university. And this frat, we were discussing the election inevitably, and he said to me, well, Frank, November 8th, Election Day, was a much better day for historians than it was for political scientists. Political scientists got it all wrong, but historians are better equipped to deal with contingency and to explain things. And I took some comfort from that. And to some extent, that's the purpose of this podcast.
Yeah.
That's our rationale. Perlstein's is a cautionary note, because Perlstein's essay basically argues that he missed the rise of Trump, and that other historians of the rise of conservatism and historians of conservatism in the United States missed the rise of Trump, in part because they subscribed and they studied a version of conservatism that was much more genteel than that represented by Trump and Trumpism. And Perlstein, in this essay, goes back and kind of briefly surveys both the historiography but also the conservative tendency in the United States, and finds it, frankly, in a historic context, much more atavistic and racist and virulent and quasi-fascistic in some of the qualities we've seen in Trumpism throughout. And he said those qualities were always there, and we just ignored them because we didn't give them their due attention.
Yeah. And so the narrative he gives in the article, the sort of the version that historians had agreed upon prior to the election about sort of the origins or the genealogy of modern conservatism, has the conservatives largely fractured after World War II. You have the rise of the National Review and William F. Buckley as sort of the epicenter of the conservative movement, and it's a, you know, an aristocratic kind of conservatism, a highly educated kind of conservatism, you know, one that in some ways is embodied in people like Goldwater, but then later in Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush, and maybe in Mitt Romney too, I guess, as a sort of through line of a sort of rational kind of conservative, one that is based on certain kinds of, you know, economic principles about limited government, about reducing taxes, about, you know, stopping government interference in people's lives. You know, and the problem with that is Trump doesn't seem to fit into those, that kind of mold in any kind of meaningful, sometimes, in some ways he does, but for the most part he doesn't.
I'd qualify that slightly, David, because certainly in Pearlstein's account, he sees Goldwater as an outlier from those groups, in that he represented, if you will, an attempt to push back at that. I mean, I guess there's a tendency or a tension in the history of American conservatism in the middle of the 20th century between, if you will, Western, more populist conservatism and the kind of more genteel,
well, to be sure,
Rockefeller Republicans of the Northeast.
But you know, if you think about sort of Goldwater's sort of articulation in sort of like Conscience of a Conservative, or the book that he wrote prior to running for president, or had ghostwritten prior to running for president, you know, he says, "I'm opposed to civil rights, but not for racist reasons. I'm opposed to civil rights because I'm interested in limited government, and I don't want government telling people who they have to associate with." You know, and so you have sort of slightly, you know, different versions of this sort of mainstream conservative movement, whether it's, you know, the sort of Connecticut conservatives, you know, like the Bushes or like Buckley, that are, you know, Yale educated and speak with, you know, aristocratic accents and you know.
Yeah, but I mean, you're right. Yeah. But I think that there was in Goldwater's candidacy a lot of dog whistle language that appealed to people. So although Goldwater himself again denied being racist, and I think that was correct, his candidacy pandered to folks the further right, and the interpretation that Pearlstein and others have subscribed to is Goldwater's catastrophic failure in 1964 represented a repudiation of that kind of those tactics, and the rise of Reagan in response to that was a sort of a corrective. Yeah. And so that was the story, but I guess the belief was, well, American conservatives, you know, reached a fork in the road in 1964 and went in a certain direction, and that direction shouldn't have led us to Trump. Mm. And it turns out that it might have actually been a kind of cul-de-sac, and they came back round Goldwater and that kind of Goldwaterism.
I think, but even more than that, they've come around. You know, one of the things that he points out in the article is that historians have largely ignored the more fringe elements or labeled elements of the conservative movement as being fringy and therefore not relevant. And I think part of what he was trying to do was saying, like, those things that we thought were fringe movements weren't as fringy and as irrelevant as we thought they were. You know, that we need to pay attention to, you know, McCarthyism as a sort of a kind of conservatism that has, you know, long-standing roots to today. You know, and the racist elements of the conservative movement aren't as marginal as we thought they were, you know. And so, you know, the ways in which, you know, we had looked at Republicans or primaries going back for the past, you know, 20 years, you end up with, you know, 10 candidates at the beginning of them, but invariably the person who ends up getting the nomination had always been the, you know, moderate mainstream conservative Republican. So you ended up with, you know, both the Bushes, you ended up with McCain, who was, you know, who was kind of radical in some ways, but on other things is not, you know, out of line with, you know, sort of what might be considered reasonable Republicanism. And you end up with, you know, Mitt Romney, who is, you know, very much in that vein of being a business Republican. And I sort of assumed the same thing was going to happen this election cycle, where you had a bunch of Republican candidates, including some crazy people who, for, you know, would briefly rise to the top, but then eventually I'd assume that, you know, Jeb Bush was going to get it or something. And clearly I was monstrously wrong about that.
Well, you weren't alone. We all were. but I think you're right. And if you reflect back on the history of the Republican Party, you think back to the 1992 election.
Yeah.
Pat Buchanan was a kind of ran as a xenophobic nationalist. We didn't use the phrase alt-right back then, but if we did, that would have applied to, yes, a lot of his rhetoric in 92. And he was seen as an outlier. He gave a speech at the 92 Republican convention that was seen as outrageous,
yeah,
by mainstream Republicans. Fast forward to 2016, and Donald Trump is running on exactly that platform and using exactly that, in fact, cruder versions of that rhetoric. Because Pat Buchanan was much more articulate than Donald Trump, or is much more articulate than Donald Trump. And so we see the shift in the party really to the rightward, and embracing, as Perlstein says, these kind of elements of conservatism that were not really spoken of in polite company, and that historians, frankly, and he's not alone in this. Yeah. I mean, it's brave of him to take responsibility for this, but it's not on him. Have neglected and ignored.
In reading his piece and just thinking about this over the past few months, I mean, one thing that struck me is that we don't have a conservative. The Republican Party is an umbrella party. That's the structure of American political parties that they tend to sort of
Democrats are as well.
Well, yeah. So that we tend to sort of coalesce around two parties, and they tend to have a variety of different philosophies within them. But the conservative movement is not a movement. I think there's a variety of different conservative movements, and I think historians have tried, have ignored some of the more fringy parts of it at our peril. The nationalist part of it is, well, I think actually Trump is dealing with this right now, because on one hand, his party's in power, on the other hand, the party in power can't get anything done because the party in power doesn't agree with itself on much of anything. And I think that's, because the radicalness of these different parts of conservatism don't speak to each other in any meaningful way. The nationalists don't speak to the libertarian, the Ayn Rand people don't speak to the, build a wall people. So there's a complexity to conservatism that we haven't fully taken account of historically, and try to figure out how to put those pieces back together, I think, will be trying to make sense of this election. It's going to be a job for a whole generation of historians to come.
Well, and I think Rick Perlstein will probably keep writing these volumes, so he could be the guy to do it. Although he's just got down to Reagan, and it's taken four massive volumes to do it, so he might end up with a work that's ultimately longer than Gibbon in the end. One thing I think that he didn't account for in the essay, which partially explains perhaps why we were all a little bit surprised, is the change in the media landscape.
Mm.
I mean, again, to take the comparison I made a moment ago, if you consider, well, what's the difference between 1992 and 2016? Well, on one hand, the Republican Party itself is different, the demography of the country is different, et cetera, et cetera. But a key factor has been the rise of conservative media and overtly partisan media. You cited William F. Buckley in the National Review. Well, that's a pretty staid, highbrow political magazine.
There's not a lot of yelling in the National
Review. No, there's not a lot of yelling in the National Review. Yet, what we've seen launched in 1996 is Fox News. And I think the importance of Fox News, and then kind of growing out of that, although not directly related to it, thanks to the technology and the internet, the rise of really right-wing social media and Breitbart and various websites. I think that's changed the landscape and also helps to explain why these views, which were previously seen as marginal, receive so much attention and been amplified so much. Because, well, just as we're doing our own podcast, anybody can do a podcast.
Exactly.
Thanks, technology. But Fox News plays a major role in all this. And in the context of the news this week, of course, we've seen a real important moment in the history of Fox News, I think, in the fall of Bill O'Reilly. Now, I don't think that means that Fox News has necessarily changed.
No, I don't think Fox News has changed.
But Bill O'Reilly's rather ignominious exit from Fox News after 20 years as its biggest star.
Yeah.
Thanks to sexual harassment allegations, is an interesting moment.
Well, and it's interesting that he's being sacked. I mean, I'm glad he's sacked. I think he's been a detriment to American politics, but that's personal rather than... But he wasn't sacked for what he said on screen. You know, he wasn't sacked for the racist statements he made. He wasn't sacked for his factually wrong statements about President Obama, about Hillary Clinton, about, you know, the ways in which he sort of corrupted or you know, inserted all this vitriol into American politics. Those weren't the reasons he got fired. Those are the reasons he was on the air, right? And that's the reason why he had such high ratings, was because of his, you know, capacity to make his viewers angry. And
that's right. I mean, he was a mouthpiece for and a manifestation of those kind of atavistic right-wing trends that Perlstein's talking about. Yeah. And his fall was not because of those. Mm. His fall, in fact, his fall wasn't even because of his misbehavior. His fall was because of the boycott, the pressure brought to bear on advertisers, and the fact that advertisers bailed on Fox News and his program, rather, in response to the allegations of his mistreatment of female employees going back for years. And so his fall was a response to corporate pressure, which is interesting, perhaps relates to our second topic to some extent. But the success of Fox News and O'Reilly's two decades of dominating cable TV news in the United States is a partial explanation for why that genteel version of conservatism seems to have died out in the United States, because it's the rise of Fox News and O'Reilly in particular led to a coarsening of public discourse, especially on the right.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, one of the things you did have in sort of the middle part of the 20th century, when you had three networks, all of which were sort of aiming at this sort of large central, you know, body of viewers, you know, when they had political debates on, or when they had sort of, you know, tried to address issues, they'd have a slightly right of center and a slightly left of center commentator come on. So you'd have William F. Buckley go on television every Sunday, you know, and he'd get into a argument with, you know, whoever's, you know, liberal interlocutor.
Well, famously Gore Vidal.
But, you know, they're very, very different than what happens on Fox News. There isn't any debate on any meaningful level on Fox News.
No, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
All right. Topic number two, passenger who was kicked off, there was a passenger kicked off of United Airlines. I guess it was now almost a couple weeks ago.
Flight from Chicago to Louisville.
And he was removed from the flight when United needed the seats, I guess, for some crew members who were needed on a flight somewhere else. And I think everyone has seen the cell phone recordings of him being removed by, I believe, the Chicago airport police.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's been sort of a firestorm of controversy ever since then, both by about his treatment and about United Airlines' response to this event. But we had a question from one of our listeners, and actually a former student of ours, Craig, here in Edinburgh, who asked us a question about what this says about the relationship between business and the police. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, this is a story that's been told in the media, and it's primarily the anger has been directed at United. But it's also in some ways a story about police brutality. I mean, the people who dragged him off the plane were members of the Chicago Airport Police. And, you know, it hasn't been told that way, but I think it's an interesting case about the relationship between capitalism and the ways in which police tend to sort of side with corporations, you know, over the interests of both consumers and labor. One of the things that sort of struck me in thinking about this is, you know, the story we often tell children about, you know, who the police are. You know, what do police officers do? Police officers, the story we tell is, you know, police officers are there to protect us. And I'm not sure historically, they protect us from bad people and criminals and what have you. But I'm not sure historically that actually pans out about what the role of the police is in regulating society.
Oh, hold on a second, David. Hold on. In responding to you, I want to make clear I am not defending the Chicago Airport Police.
Although you are a frequent United flyer.
And their frequent and their treatment of Dr. Dow, the poor gentleman who was dragged off the plane battered and bloody. But are you suggesting, and I want to return to the United incident, yeah. But are you suggesting, is your overall thesis in response to this,
well,
that, hold on, that the police don't protect the public and that they're always in acting in the interests of capital?
I would argue that there's a and maybe I'm going to sound like a Marxist here, whatever, police historically protect people with power and property against people who don't have power and property. That we often, and I mean, there's two versions about sort of what law and law enforcement do. And the version I think we like to tell, and lawyers tell themselves this, is that they're there to protect the weak from the powerful. Well, they also protect the powerful from the weak and re-inscribe the power of the powerful. I think law and both law enforcement do both of those things. And we can obviously think of lots of cases where, and we tend to champion those cases in which law and law enforcement protect the weak. But I think it's, especially, maybe not just especially, but in the sort of long view of American history, police, for the most part, have, when they have a choice between deciding between the interests of capital and the interests of either consumers or labor, they almost always side with the interests of capital. And we can think back into, say, the 19th century, where, labor disputes were rife in the United States, and the police get called in on all of those cases, and they side almost universally with the interests of capital over the interests of labor. One can think of maybe say like the Pullman strike from the 1890s. This is a very famous case in which the workers in the Pullman, Illinois. Pullman was a company town that produced these palace cars, these fancy railroad cars. Basically, the corporation owned everything in the town. The sort of grossly simplify the story. There was a Great Depression that starts in 1893, and the corporation lowered wages for all the employees, but they didn't lower the prices they charged employees who lived in the town for things. The employees went on strike. That starts a national railroad strike led by Eugene Debs, and the government basically steps in and crushes the strike, arguing that the strike is interfering with the delivering of the mail. But you can think of other sort of incidences from the late 19th and early 20th century of police power, whether it's police power through the military or police power through the police, siding with corporate interests over pretty much anything else. And, one thing that struck me with the United case is that, United has a problem. They call the police come immediately in, and there didn't, I watched the videos, and obviously the cell phone videos are, they start only at a certain point. You don't get to see the backstory of it, but the police didn't come in and, adjudicate, here's the, passenger, here's what the airline says, let us independently investigate this. The supposition is the airline wants this person off. We're going to drag the person off regardless of their, what the person says about the merits of their case. There's sort of a supposition of guilt or supposition that the airline is in the right.
Right. I mean, let's talk about the United case because I think it's interesting in a lot of ways. I mean, it's terrible. As you said, I'm a United frequent flyer.
They do fly into Edinburgh.
They do.
I've flown on them a bunch of times.
And a couple of weeks ago, right after several days after this incident, I was flying on United from San Francisco back to Edinburgh via Newark. And when I made my connection in Newark, I was sitting in the terminal and I heard a couple of United crew, a couple of pilots talking to each other. And they were fairly sanguine about the whole thing. But one of them said, well, it was the police overreacted, but the guy should have got off the plane.
Mm.
And they were talking about the fact, and there was a lot of focus on United's response. You're absolutely right. The focus and the public backlash was directed at United, not at the police, when this could very well be an incident, could be interpreted and perhaps should be interpreted as an incident of police brutality. The United policy seems to be stupid. United seems to have been unlucky in the sense that all airlines in the U.S. seem to overbook deliberately and kick people off. And that policy's been examined at great length in the past couple of weeks. But the police aspect of this, I totally agree with you and to Craig, our correspondent, has been kind of ignored. Mm. And those pilots, though, that I overheard were making the point, no, this was a police problem in the way the police responded. And you're right, the police did not, there did not seem to be a danger to anyone. So if we talk about the, you know, when is violence an appropriate response, Dr. Dow did not seem to be posing a danger to anybody. On the other hand, post 9/11, airline travel is one area where we have no rights, it turns out. Yeah, and have, you know, the minute you enter an airport, and certainly the minute you encounter security in an airport and go through to go to your gate, you cede most of your rights, it seems, at least in principle, if not in practice. And so I think the authority of the police to do what they want, or what the airlines want, which is your thesis, is pretty considerable. I agree with you in that case. I'm not sure I'd go so far as to say that the police, to support your generalized conclusion, that the police always support capital. Yeah. So one thinks about the civil rights movement, for example. Now, we know that the police, particularly local police and state police in southern states, frequently used violence to oppose civil rights. But we also know that the FBI, not always the most enlightened or progressive institution in the history of the United States or its government, acted to protect civil rights activists. Mm. And so it can be... it's perhaps more nuanced than you're allowing.
I'm overstating the case, but you know, it strikes me that you know the role that the police power has played, you know, in American history. You know, whether that's you know here in United, whether it's in the civil rights movement. You know, where they're 99 times out of 100 siding with you know white business owners over people who are doing sit-ins or people who are doing, you know, bus rides or what have you, or going back into labor strikes, or if you want to sort of do sort of an antecedent to the police, modern police forces, if you look at like slave patrols, which are in some ways, some historians have argued are a precursor to modern police forces, you know, those are there distinctly to keep certain classes of people enslaved and to empower and reinscribe power in people who already have power. It seems in many ways that the police forces have been designed in such a way as to you know they do protect people who have power and authority and property, and corporations have historically you know at least since the late 19th century had a disproportionate amount of power, authority, and property, and you know, and this seems to be sort of another example of that, and a fairly long trajectory of it.
Yes, and there's an irony at the heart of all this, because of course, the United States was created in part as a result of a protest movement against excessive state power.
Yeah,
you know, the resistance movement against the British Empire was in large part. Motivated and animated by a concern about the abuse of power by the state.
Yeah.
And the result was the creation of a state that actually has a great deal of coercive power over its citizens, and as you say, exercises it, let's say, unevenly.
Yeah, well, and I mean, just to state the obvious, I mean, the way in which, you know, the police power has been used, you know, has been disproportionately against people of color and people who are poor, you know, and so, you know, when police are, we think about police harassment, we think about police violence, And obviously, I think this is an example of police violence what happened on United. The fact that it was, happened to a person of color, even if it was a, somebody who was a physician, I think is telling.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, the racial dynamic of this in United is in big, big trouble in China, for example, as a result of this. There's a real backlash against United Airlines in China as a result of this incident. And I think the airline is probably correct in the sense that in their response, they said, look, race had nothing to do with our identifying him as a passenger who needed to get off. And I think that's probably true. I think I think that corporations are more sensitive than that today.
Yeah, not that stupid.
Exactly. I'm not here to defend United Airlines. However, I do. I think you're onto something in the sense that if it had been you or I on that in that seat and the police had come, would they have responded in the same way? We will never know that, but I do think that the racial aspect of this story is significant, but I think it's more significant in terms of the use of police power than United's
state. Yeah. Well, the other thing that struck me about United's policy was, they do have, they said, they picked them randomly about who to pick. But they also said that in terms of picking somebody random, they're not going to pick somebody in first class, and they're not going to pick somebody who is a, platinum member of their frequent flyer program. And so it privileges people who are buying the cheap tickets getting bumped.
It doesn't privilege them.
Well, it privileges them in terms of putting the high in the bump. So the people who are getting bumped are not going to be people in first class. They're not going to make it truly a random person on the plane. It's going to be the people in the cheap seats rather than the people who are, have power and authority within the sort of structure of the class system of the airline.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I mean, but I don't think he was necessarily singled out for his race. In fact, I don't think that was a factor. But I think his race may have played a factor in the way he was treated by the police.
Oh, to be sure. I
agree with you on that. Although I do want to stipulate, in case I ever want to return to the United States and run for office, that on this podcast, I apparently am the law and order candidate.
I think I'm probably never going to run for office, so I'm happy to sort of incriminate myself. All right. Time for our last drops, Frank. What do you got?
House of Cards, David. It's going to be huge.
We have to...
I finally caught up with House of Cards. As you all know, if you've made it through the previous 13 episodes of this podcast, I've been on the road. And so I was watching Netflix while I was on the road, and I finally finished season 4 of House of Cards in anticipation of season 5, which is starting in a few weeks' time, in May. And I enjoyed it. You don't really care what I think about House of Cards. What struck me, however, is that in light, and of course it premiered several years ago. I'm always late to the show on this. I hear Game of Thrones is going to be huge. So I came to this relatively late, but it was made, 3 or 4 years ago, during the Obama presidency, it debuted. And I have to say, in watching the fourth season, I was underwhelmed in the sense that reality has trumped art, sense that the Trump presidency, and I shouldn't have said Trump, I suppose, but the Trump presidency is so crazy and absurd, it's rendered House of Cards kind of dull.
How do you get political entry if the real politics are so unbelievable?
So I'll watch Series 5, but I'm because I'm kind of invested at this point, but... unfortunately, reality has ruined House of Cards.
Watching House of Cards 24 hours a day. You don't need to wait until the next season opens. All right.
Well, that's true. And the escapist aspect of it is no longer there. I mean, I think the West Wing's going to make a comeback because it's the presidency as we want it to be.
Mr. Smith goes to Washington all of a sudden.
So I guess to follow up that thought, House of Cards worked really well during the Obama presidency, which seemed to be a sunny, optimistic time. And we wanted this kind of, we wanted to believe, there's all sorts of chicanery going on behind the scenes. And it fit that view. Paradoxically, because we are at a time when our politics seems to be much darker, House of Cards doesn't really work. And we want something like, perhaps like the West Wing.
West Wing was popular, during the end of Clinton, when there are all the Clinton scandals, and the beginning of W. So there's...
What's your last drop, David?
All right, so tomorrow is Earth Day. Happy Earth Day, everybody. And it is also the day we're having these marches for science all over the place. There's one here in Edinburgh, there's one in Washington, there's one every place. Everyone should go out and march for science. Science is good. But they're also, tomorrow is being released a new show on HBO. I guess it's the day we're endorsing premium shows. I don't actually get HBO. I don't have a television. But they're releasing on HBO tomorrow a movie, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, which is based on a 2010 book, I believe, by Rebecca Skloot. Frank, you read
The Immortal? That's a great book.
Yeah. It's an amazing book about, for those of you who haven't read, sort of the sort of cliff note version of it, is the story of a poor African-American woman who is diagnosed with cancer in the early 1950s. She's taken into to Johns Hopkins, and they find out that the tumor that she has, the cancer, is actually has remarkable scientific value. They were having difficulty replicating human cells in the lab, and this particular cancer group of cancer cells where they were able to reproduce and do all kinds of scientific experiments. And basically all of medical science that's been done in the past 50 years has been built in some ways on the cells from this poor African-American woman. And the book is in large part about sort of the story of her cells, but also the stories of her family and the ways in which her family, like, first didn't know for 30 or 40 years about, you know, what had happened with part of Henrietta Lacks's body with when the cells were removed from her. So it's a really interesting book. I'd highly recommend the book. The movie stars Oprah, who is, I guess, you know, making a return to screen after her 3 decades of talk, hosting a talk show. So, you know, by all means, I think if it's half as good as the book, it's worth watching.
Excellent. Thank you, David.
All right. Till next week, Frank.
Cheers. Cheers.
Hey, folks, it's David. We forgot to record the coda while Frank was still here, so I'm going to do it now. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can follow us at Whiskey Rebel Pod. You can also find us on Facebook. If you're listening to this, you're probably listening to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or Podbean. Like, this is probably the last week I'm going to make a reminder about this, because we're doing our book giveaway here at the end of the month for a randomly selected or 2 randomly selected reviews on iTunes. So please leave a review there. It helps people find the show. We really appreciate it. Great. Let's talk to you all next week.